21-2984, Lisa Bergman versus Jeremy Howard. Argument not to exceed 15 minutes per side. Mr. Benton Martin, you may proceed for the appellant.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court, Benton Martin on behalf of Lisa Bergman. I'm reserving 3 minutes for rebuttal. Lisa Bergman is serving 25 to 50 years for second degree murder because of a tragic car accident. The trial court left Bergman essentially defenseless in the face of an onslaught of experts, including 6 forensic scientists, 2 toxicologists, 3 medical examiners. And her attorney had no more than a high school education in chemistry, as he explained repeatedly to the court in asking for a toxicology expert. Where I'd like to start is our argument that the Michigan Court of Appeals reached an unreasonable determination of the facts in deciding that the lawyer had not explained the need for an expert. And I pointed you to the district court's conclusions, which I think are more articulate than mine, on pages 13, 05, and 06, his decision, where the district court said the Michigan Court of Appeals' conclusion that Bergman's lawyer failed to adequately explain his need for a toxicology expert was unreasonable. I agree with that part of the district court's analysis. He also looked at 4 ways that the attorney had explained why there was a need for this expert: to critically analyze the toxicology expert's conclusions, to help construct and formulate cross-examination questions that were aimed at casting doubt. He could have sought his own opinion on Ms. Bergman's blood levels. And I think critically, and I think what is one of the critical facts that the state court didn't apprehend, was that so the attorney himself could understand what was going on with these lab reports.
Why do you think that's a determination of fact? I agree with the district court that appellate courts don't often engage in fact finding. They usually defer to the trial court unless it's clearly erroneous. Why shouldn't we, for instance, analogize to ineffective assistance of counsel, where there's historical facts about what happened where you would defer, but the ultimate conclusion on sufficient performance or the ultimate conclusion on prejudice are legal conclusions, really mixed questions, but questions that courts review de novo. And I would say that that's essentially what the Michigan Court of Appeals found, which is the reasons that you have just articulated were not sufficient reasons to warrant an expert. And that was a legal conclusion about the scope of the due process.
I agree that's how the district court looked at it, and I don't disagree with your way of analogizing. I do think that when you look at some of the case law that I've cited, there is reasons why a mixed question of law and fact can be an unreasonable determination of the facts. And I would particularly point you to the Kipp versus Davis decision that I cited, where they march through different ways that something can be an unreasonable of the facts, and a misapprehension critical to a petitioner's claim that undermines the reasonableness of the court's decision can be one of those. That's what I think happened here, and I think that the district court, when it was making its decision, said that our argument was that the Court of Appeals thought that there had been no explanation given at all. And that isn't true. They recognized that there was some explanation, but they just found that it wasn't sufficient. I think the problem is a little different than that, in that when you look through the factual recitation by the Michigan Court of Appeals, there are several things that are not addressed. They don't mention how the trial attorney had explained that he really didn't even know how to begin to look at these lab reports without talking to a professional. And nowhere is that mentioned in the state court's opinion. I think that's overlooking a critical fact.
I'm still troubled by the notion that appellate courts engage in fact-finding. Isn't that quite unusual?
can be an unreasonable determination of the facts. At which point this court looks at the due process right without having to see if the Supreme Court has directly decided this case, or one of these cases is more directly on point.
As I read the record, there was a colloquy, and the end result was that the trial court said that, well, I don't see it now, at least with respect to retesting, but you can raise it again later and tell me why you need it. And the attorney said, well, I will file another motion that's more clear when I get the material I need. And then there's nothing else. Am I missing something?
No, and I don't have the exact language in front of me. I think that is something that the district court here didn't address in terms of what did he somehow
do. I can't read. That's something wrong.
Sorry. The district court did not address if that was some form of default, if he didn't renew that motion. I'm not sure what else the attorney would have been able to say to the trial court at that point, because without an expert to say exactly how this evidence could have been attacked, there really wasn't much more, I think, that Mr. Ladd, the trial attorney, could have told the trial court in terms of what an expert would have shown without first consulting with an expert. I believe he had sufficiently made his record as to why this expert was needed.
That goes to the underlying standard, though, about when you're entitled to an expert. I must say, I read Aki, and then I read Medina, and it strikes me that it's very difficult to even figure out what the governing legal standard is here. And the reason I say that is because Aki found a due process right to a psychiatrist, and its
find this is evidence that was critical to determining guilt. And there really isn't a difference between psychology or psychiatric evidence and this type of evidence. It's a very complex science, toxicology. So to deprive defendants of that, I think, is really fundamentally unfair, which under either approach, I believe, we should prevail.
Did the Michigan Court of Appeals apply the correct test and then just misapply it, or was it the wrong test?
We're not making an argument that their application was contrary to. Our argument would be that it was an unreasonable application of ACK. So they did acknowledge the ACK case, but then it was an unreasonable application of that and finding that they hadn't made the necessary showing.
So I'm still trying to pin that down. Is it that they used the wrong test, or that they got the test right but unreasonably applied it?
Correct. I think that they got the test right but unreasonably applied it.
Thank you, counsel. You have your rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. Jared Schultz, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Michigan, on behalf of the respondent.
Can you get the mic closer to you, please?
Yes, I apologize, Your Honor.
I think it's up as high as it'll go. Yeah, I think it's as high as it'll go.
Okay, thank you. I'll try to lean over, Your Honor.
Much better.
So I think it's important in any habeas action to remember the posture of the case. I know it's especially true in this case because I think it's dispositive and ultimately controls the outcome. Section 2254, AEDPA, provides clear and strict rules for guiding this court's review. A petitioner must identify a holding from the Supreme Court that the state court's decision contradicted or was an unreasonable application of. Here, the petitioner, whatever the merits of the claim that there should be a right to a toxicologist or some other sort of expert in a certain case, whatever the merits of that claim, it doesn't matter here because the Supreme Court has never held that such a right exists, and therefore the Michigan Court of Appeals decision cannot be contrary to or an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law. Now, again, as I said, the petitioner must identify a holding from the Supreme Court. I think there's two ways that the petitioner tries to go about doing that in this case, and one is to look at the Britt Griffin line of cases, and the other is to look directly at ACKI. Neither of them work here under AEDPA. First, for the Britt Griffin line of cases, all they held was that there's a general due process right to the basic tools of an adequate defense. But the Supreme Court has said when interpreting AEDPA that the more general the rule, the more leeway courts have on a case-by-case basis in applying that rule. And the Supreme Court has also said that federal court on habeas review cannot refine or sharpen a rule, a general principle, into a specific rule that the Supreme Court has not yet announced.
Well, do you have an opinion on how we should go about determining whether some expert is necessary to the defense? Do you think, you know, I mentioned the balancing tests versus the historical test. Do you think we should just do away with both of those and just ask on it? Case-by-case basis, is this particular evidence necessary? Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't think it matters in this case because the Supreme Court has not yet done that. If this was on direct review, I perhaps would have an opinion that you know, you can do the case-by-case or the three steps in Matthews v. Eldridge or what have you. But it doesn't matter here because the Supreme Court has not gone through that analysis. The Supreme Court has gone through that analysis and said that for psychiatric witnesses, when the insanity defense is at issue, yes, those three factors weigh in the defendant's favor. They're entitled to a psychiatric expert. The Supreme Court has not done that with any other expert, with expert witnesses in general. The Supreme Court just has not done that. And therefore, on habeas review, this court can't do that. All this court can do is say, what was it an unreasonable application of clearly established federal law for the Michigan Supreme or the Michigan Court of Appeals to
do that? What do you think? Your friend on the other side suggested that the Michigan Court of Appeals identified the correct legal rule, but applied it unreasonably. And it's not even clear to me what the correct legal rule is. Like, how do we determine? The Michigan Court of Appeals seemed to say, did you identify a sufficient nexus to something in the case that requires this expert? Do you think that that is a legal rule that has been clearly established by the Supreme Court, or do you think we're just kind of out to sea because the Supreme Court hasn't really articulated for us how we're supposed to go about this?
Right, Your Honor. So I guess I'll start by the sufficient nexus test. I believe that comes from the Michigan Supreme Court's decision in People v. Kennedy. And what Kennedy did was it said that AKE applies in, or AKE, I'm not sure how you pronounce it either, applies in these circumstances, and that was their interpretation of AKE, was that you have to have a sufficient nexus. I think they also quoted some other federal circuit courts to come up with that rule. And that exactly shows that that's not clearly established Supreme Court law. The only rule that AKE established was that you are entitled to a psychiatric witness. It didn't come up with a standard. It just said you are entitled to a psychiatric witness when one is insanity is an issue. It didn't come up with a legal framework for evaluating other experts. It confined its analysis to psychiatric experts. That was the holding of the Supreme Court. So I don't think you can use AKE in this circumstance to say that the Michigan Court of Appeals unreasonably applied it. I think you have to go back to what my opposing counsel points to is the Britt and Griffin line of cases, but because that is so general, the basic tools of an adequate defense, that doesn't say anything about what are the basic tools of an adequate defense. It doesn't say that experts are required in certain circumstances.
What if you have a situation where the facts are abundantly clear that the only way the defendant could defend against the charge would be to show that the prosecution's experts were wrong about certain conclusions. And the subject matter is very technical or requires expertise. I mean, are there any situations where you might say, yeah, the Supreme Court hasn't said that you're entitled to an expert in this particular situation, but there was no defense?
Well, I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. However, I think that the rules that the Supreme Court has outlined for evaluating cases when AEDPA applies clearly say you cannot. There has to be a specific holding from the Supreme Court that addresses that issue.
But what about the holdings that say that you're entitled to the material, the raw material that's necessary to assert the defense?
I guess I would point to the fact that is a very general standard, and the Supreme Court has repeatedly said that the more general the principle, the more leeway state courts have.
But are there any situations where the violation of that general principle would be so obvious that you can't just rely on it?
I think that, well, you always have to rely on AEDPA. I think I understand what you're saying, Your Honor. Correct.
I mean the specific decision.
Correct. So I think there could be a situation where it is so obvious that they violated the rule that he or she was entitled to the basic rules of adequate defense. However, because of the leeway given, I think that it has to be entirely obvious. And in this case, it wasn't there.
How is she, as I understand understand basically the prosecution's case is that she had a lot of different substances, and there was no evidence that any of those substances were not within therapeutic limits. And so there's nothing inherently illegal about any of this. And then the theory is, well, the mix of all of them, or perhaps even one of them alone, made her unable to safely operate a vehicle, and she knew that. So how do you, and you've got one expert who says, well, I don't, in my opinion, she wasn't fit to drive. So how does she defend against that without having somebody who is able to say, well, that's not necessarily so, and for these reasons, because this chemical works like this, and, you know, on and on, or enlightens her attorney on how to cross-examine that expert?
Well, Your Honor, first I would go against your point that these were not within therapeutic levels. That really is irrelevant. You know, all these drugs were powerful drugs, powerful muscle relaxant or powerful painkillers. You know, most of them say you can't operate a vehicle whether they're in therapeutic levels or not. But to your main point, Your Honor, I guess that's where I would go to my harmless error analysis here. This case was not about experts. This case was about the petitioner's past and what she knew. Whether she was intoxicated or not, she knew that she, when she took these drugs and then got behind the wheel, that she could not drive safely. She caused several accidents. She passed out behind the wheel. She was driving so erratically that the police were called on her. And that happened 6 times, and that's what the prosecution relied on. In fact, in the opening statement, the prosecution never once mentioned the opinion testimony. In her closing argument, the prosecution, when specifically addressing the second-degree murder charge, never mentioned the expert opinion testimony. Instead, she went through one by one each of those different instances that showed she knew what would happen if she got behind the wheel while ingesting those same drugs. And she knew that she could cause an accident and that someone, you know, might die or was seriously injured as a result. And therefore, she knowingly created a very high risk that death or serious bodily injury would occur. The only time she ever even mentioned the expert opinion testimony was when she was outlining the elements of operating while intoxicated causing death. It was not within the second-degree murder charge. The second-degree murder charge, the other acts were the prosecution's case.
Do you think, you said you describe it under harmless error, but I wonder if that goes to whether there's a violation at all in the sense of whether any type of right to expert assistance has been triggered depends on how important the expert will be to the case. And obviously, it was very important because insanity defense was the exclusive defense, I think is what the decision said, so there really was no other defense. Here, the prosecutor really relied on the prior crimes. The defendant maybe didn't have experts, but the defendant had a pretty good defense. The defense was that everybody who saw me right after the accident suggested that I was perfectly competent, and no suggestion that I was impaired. And so, do you think that this goes into kind of if we describe it at the highest level of generality of when it's necessary for a case, that this type of evidence goes into whether that standard has been satisfied?
Yeah. I think that's right, Your Honor. So again, Ake said that when insanity is, I believe, seriously at issue or a serious issue in the case, that's when the defendant makes that showing, that's when they're entitled to an expert. I don't think the petitioner here has made that showing precisely because of what you said, and it kind of dovetails with the harmless error analysis. This case the expert toxicology evidence was not seriously at issue. Her past acts were what were seriously at issue. That's what this case was about. So yes, I agree with you, Your Honor, that that goes to whether there's a violation at all. I think those analyses kind of go together and they interact and intertwine. So yes, I agree, Your Honor. And I see my time is getting close to being up. If there are any more questions, I'd be happy to answer them. Otherwise, I'd ask the district court to you to affirm the district court.
I'd like to make 3 points. The first is I disagree, just as a factual matter, about the importance of this testimony.
Can you get closer to the mic, please?
Thank you, Judge White. I apologize. The first point I'd like to make is on the factual issue of how important this was. I point you to the district court, page ID 1303-04, where he talks about the importance of Dr. Glenn's testimony and emphasizes that Dr. Glenn's testimony became a focal point of the final arguments to the jury, and the prosecution highlighted the testimony several times during its closing and reminded the jury of the testimony about the combination of these drugs and their effect of those drugs on the body. Really, that became one of the crucial issues because Judge Murphy, her real defense was, I wasn't impaired that night, given that people saw me and no one thought I was impaired. The paramedics didn't think I was impaired. Dr. Glenn's testimony really became extremely crucial. And there was no...
But how do you define crucial? Because, I mean, you could articulate the rule as, I cannot present any other evidence to undermine the idea that I wasn't impaired. But she was, defense counsel actually was able to bring out quite a bit of evidence that she wasn't impaired through these types of interactions. And so why shouldn't we think if there is any type of constitutional right to a toxicologist, it should be when there's no alternative way to present that type of evidence?
Because I think there's a real difference between that type of evidence that a layperson can put on about I'm not impaired versus when someone comes up and they emphasized her credentials, Dr. Glenn's credentials. She had a PhD. She was part of an elite institute, and the prosecution emphasized that in closing. And I think that when you have that type of evidence, it has a real effect on the jury. And I'd point the court to Hinton from the Supreme Court, which doesn't address exactly this issue, but in the end of that opinion, they talk about the serious deficiencies in forensic science used in criminal trials. And by one account, invalid scientific evidence has contributed to 60% of all overturned criminal convictions. I think that speaks to how powerful this evidence is and how much of a risk it creates. And just one brief point on the issue of the standard here. And, you know, really even in Medina, it says an indigent criminal defendant is entitled to the minimum assistance necessary to ensure him a fair opportunity to present his defense and to participate meaningfully in the judicial proceeding. I recognize that's broad, but the Supreme Court's case in Panetti says, EPA does not require state and federal courts to wait for some nearly identical fact pattern before a legal rule must be applied. The statute recognizes that even a general standard may be applied in an unreasonable manner. We believe that's what happened here, so we'd ask